Awesome. So hi, everybody. I'm Alex. I'm Alcoholic. And you guys hear me? Yeah, I got waves. Good. And it's good to say, I'm going to say hi to Karen. Karen, I'm C from, we lived in Rochester. Well, I still live in Rochester, but she did for a while. We did general service together. And I think the last time that I saw you, Karen, was in Nashville too, at that, I think it was the Three Legacies group in Nashville. Because usually I'm in Nashville for Usual Suspects this weekend. That's where, and I'm not sure who Ben is. We call him Ben. he's a beautiful soul, that guy is. And that's where I met him and got plugged in. I thank you guys for allowing me to be here and to share a bit of my experience with you all. The reason I came a little bit late is I'm on my home group. My home group meets Thursday nights. We do a big book study. And tonight, Saturday night, we have it's a rotational thing where we have different types of topics, traditions, concepts, steps, spiritual awakenings. I mean, all kinds of things in AA. And it's tonight. And so I got the key. Still blows my mind. They trust me with the key. And I get to come here and I was going to set up and then drive home, where my wife said, why don't you just stay, find a room and stay here. And as soon as I was walking out to get my laptop, there was a guy, just this is me, right? I walked through one of the corridors and he's sitting in the corner by himself, shaking of like, and I think out of fear. And I just, you know, that's my guy, right? And so I go up to him and welcome him in, and we take him outside and we talk to him. And by the next thing I know, there's like five people talking to him. They've pushed me out of it. And it's just them taking on the new guy. And I was kind of pissed off. That's my guy. I got him first, you know. But it worked out great. That's why I love my home group. Like, that's the kind of deal that it is. You get a new person, whether they're female, male, anything like that. They're going to get an opportunity to find and get the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, get a sponsor, get involved in the Three Legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous, and have a fellowship and a community that changes people's lives. I mean, it changed my life, you know, and that's why I love it here. I just love it. And so I'm interested to see if anybody walks in the room. It'd be kind of fun if they do. We'll say hi to them. And it'd be kind of interesting. So anyway, my sobriety date is January 19th, 2005. And it's not when I first came to AA, but it is when I came here and stayed. And so I'm going to talk about that with you guys. I think it's important that you all know that I'm one of you, right? I'm not somebody that follows directions from people that I don't think understand or get it, right? And I think it's one of the most important things that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous was when I identified at depth with another human being. And it allowed me to, it really allowed things to get through and past my ego to a place where I was ready to take actions that made no freaking sense at all, that ended up saving my life. And so I'm going to talk about that a little bit. For me, I came up ever since I can remember, and everyone's got different stories with this. I'm not sure this is alcoholism or not. It's just the way that I look at the world is ever since I can remember, the world stage lights were on me. Like, it just seemed like everybody was paying attention to me. And it made me embarrassed. I mean, I was a guy that had so much fear of you ever finding out how I really felt about myself, about who I really was. I mean, it was overwhelming to me. Overwhelming to me. So much so that, like, I am convinced that I would have died had it not been that I found alcohol that really allowed me to be okay in my own skin for long enough till I could find Alcoholics Anonymous and a spiritual solution to my problems. I mean, I'm convinced of it. And it was brutal. I mean, none of the stuff I'm about to say makes me an alcoholic, but it definitely does alter your perspective on the world and it'll give you a bunch of character defects. And I'll tell you the one of them is that my mom has severe mental illness. And, you know, if you ever watch the show Hoarders on A&E, like, you'll see her on there. Not really, but that's the kind of deal I grew up in, was that kind of house. Like, I still can't really watch Hoarders without starting to sweat. Like, it makes me anxious. You know what I mean? That's the way it grew up. And my dad was very verbally and emotionally abusive to her. And I thought that was normal. I thought telling really, really, really mean things to her and breaking her down and seeing her screaming and crying was just how everybody was. I don't think that was anything. That's how it was. And I was super embarrassed about who I was in my family and where I came from. And And I thought everyone knew and they were always paying attention to it. And the thing that really, really opened it up for me was when I got to be 10 years old. And I don't know if anyone here has ever seen the movie Days of Wine and Roses. It's a great movie if you haven't seen it. Great flick. But there's a scene where pretty much the husband and wife become drunks. They get sober. After being sober a while, they convince each other that it'll be different this time when they drink. And he goes to crack the bottle open, and he goes to put it to his mouth, and he says these words. He says, "Magic time." And I remember when I first watched it, I just identified with that at such a deep level. Like, what alcohol did for me was just incredible. And I think it's a pretty common experience for people of our type, is what alcohol did for us, you know? And I'll tell you, at 10 years old, I didn't, like, get a fake ID and start going to the bar every day. Because that would have been ridiculous, you know, but I'll tell you, when I got drunk that day, that overwhelming self-consciousness and self-obsession really kind of left, and I became comfortable in my own skin, you know, and I loved it. And I started this, like, how do I get that again thing, you know, and I started breaking into houses, like we call it the garage hopping where I come from, you know, and all that kind of stuff to drink as much as I could, as often as I could. And I ended up in my first inpatient rehab by the time I was 15 years old. One of my best friends got sober when he was 49. He was drinking half a gallon of vodka a day and a vice president of a bank, right? He's just like me. I never got past ninth grade before I went to my first rehab. You know, my progression just went really, really fast. And before you know it, I'm kicked out of school. You probably can't tell now because it's very different, but I used to have really, really long hair. And I used to say that I had dreadlocks, but I really didn't, because I just never washed my hair and they were all just one big dreadlock. It's like one mat. It was not dreadlocks. And I used to follow around with the Grateful Dead, and you know, school wasn't where I wanted to be. And like, I found the answer to life, you know, and I got kicked out of school. I ended up in my first inpatient, and everyone in my life was really, really concerned about where I was going. And I'm sure there's a lot of you that have heard this line before. Don't you see how much you're hurting all of us? Don't you see what you're doing to yourself? You have so much potential. Who has potential in the room? I mean, we are people of potential. Oh my God, you know, and everybody has so much potential. And it's like, and they would cry and they, you know, all these things are like, you know, and being where I am today, looking back on it, if that was my daughter doing what I was doing, I understand completely what they saw. But I was just completely delusional. Like, those things weren't the problem. The problem for me, the reason things were uncomfortable and tense in my home, the reason I started becoming violent and angry all the time, was because they were trying to get in the way of the only thing I had found that gave me some kind of relief from my life sober. Alcohol worked for me. Not going to school, drinking all day, traveling the country, selling drugs and fake drugs and I finally felt okay when I was there, you know? And I remember one night, this is a good example of that. I remember one night being at a party and, you know, we're sitting outside and I'm drinking. You know that time where you drink and it's just like, you just stay in this, that you get to that place of just perfection. You know what I'm talking about? Like, you're just perfect. Like, the words are coming out of your mouth so smooth and you feel so good. There's not a worry in the world and it's just lightness. And that's how I felt. I remember I had a beer and I remember saying to my friends, I said, man, I wish this beer would never, like, as soon as it got down to the bottom, it would just immediately fill back up forever. And I could just live in that place forever, you know? And that was the most obvious observation to me. But to them, they were like, dude, that's like what alcoholics say. Like, that's what's wrong with you. What do you mean? You know? And I loved what alcohol did for me. I didn't see any other problem except for the people around me. And here's the level of selfishness that it could happen from our disease, is that I would literally have my mother bawling her eyes out. Don't you see what you're doing to our family? Don't you see what you're doing to yourself? And I would say to her this, and I would mean this. I didn't even say it to get it away from me. I meant it. You are the problem. It's not my drinking. It's not me. It's you. If you stop caring about my drinking, if you stop loving me or whatever, if you just let me be, then there'd be no problem. You're the problem. And I believed that. And so I, And so that's really how it went on and on. And I don't want to go much deeper into a drunk log. I'll tell you this. I went to AA for the first time in that rehab at 15 years old. I was raised an atheist, right? And, you know, not like agnostic, atheist. Like, let's argue about the existence of God. Like, buckle up. Let's have some fun, you know? And, because it's not real. And I remember I went to my first meeting and Alcoholics Anonymous sounded like this to me. This was, I'm sure some of you guys have seen Charlie Brown, right? I'm sure, right? And there's that character on there and this is what AA sounded like to me. Wah, 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 God. Wah, 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 brainwashed spiritual cult people. Like, that's what AA looked like to me. And it was highly offensive to me and my brilliant intellect. And I just would come there and I would just judge every single one of you. I'm sure there's probably someone in the virtual room that is like me and that they're listening to me speak and they're poking holes in everything I say. Right. And if you're doing that, I love you. I love you because I did that for years. You know, I'd be 6 days out of a detox, still sick and shaking and all kinds of beat up, a tornado of, you know, just crap behind me that I just went through. I come to a meeting and I'd listen to someone with 30 years sober talk about whatever. And I would literally judge them and argue with them about how they're wrong. You know, I get that. I get having an ego that makes it impossible to listen, to hear, that just puts up a wall that just it's like I have a force field that just puts any type of truth. It just bounces right off them, you know? I just bounced right off. And it was brutal. It was just brutal. And I ended up going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and in and out of rehabs for the next 4 years. And progressively things got worse. And by the time that I'm 18 years old, you know, my dad's dying of cancer. They give him 18 months to live. I had been in and out of psych wards and hospitals and rehabs. I was diagnosed with so many different mental illnesses on a host of different medications. And I was able to get sober. Like, I'm a guy that can get sober. I never was able to get sober by myself, but I can go to a hospital or some type of facility. You know, and I always tell people, if you can't get sober, go to your nearest hospital and tell them that you're going to kill yourself and tell them you got a plan. And I promise you, you're going to get sober. You will get sober, right? You're not going to have a belt. You're not going to have shoelaces, but you're going to get removed from alcohol. I promise you. And, but the problem is I got out. And see, I always thought that I was so smart and I had so much ability to solve problems that I could outthink this thing. I could figure it out. And when I really, really started to want to like not drink, was when my dad was dying of cancer. I loved my father and I wanted him to see me sober before he died really badly. And like every part of me, you know, and I got sober. I don't even know how many times in the 18 months that he was dying. And every time I meant business, every time. And sometimes I would last hours out of the facility. And sometimes I would last, the longest I ever lasted was 3 months sober. And the problem with it is that I thought alcohol was my problem. And it made no sense to me because when I would put alcohol away, why was I always like, I was always having such difficulty sober and I find myself drunk again, you know, and I didn't understand that. I thought I was just mentally ill. I thought I was like a schizophrenic, bipolar. I was diagnosed with so many different things, you know, and I thought I was, you know, it was just awful. And I'll tell you, like the last week of my drinking was the last week of my father's life. And, you know, this is the scene, right? I'm driving up and down the street where the hospital is that he's in hospice. And I got a half a gallon of vodka in my lap. And everyone's got to have their really good self-pity song. I love a really good dose of self-pity. I know there's some of you guys that are there with me. It's like a warm, comfortable blanket around me of just being a victim, you know? And I'm driving up and down the street listening to Evanescence. You're so broken, you know, and I'm, yes, I am. You should just die. Yeah, Kyle, you feel me? You should just die. And I want to die. I'm making light of it. I do. Like, I just didn't want to live anymore. I didn't have any hope. And, you know, and I wanted to say bye to my father, and I never was able to say bye to him. I ran out of booze, I ran out of money, I ran out of drugs, and I punched myself in the face, and I ripped my clothes up a little bit, and I went up into the hospice room, and I told my mother and my dad that people were going to kill me, and could I get some money? And they went to the ATM, my mom went to the ATM, got me some money, and I went on a bender. You know, I don't know how many days it was, but I was on a bender. I was just on a drunk. And she called me as however many days later and said that my dad had died. And would you want to come, you know, to the hospital? And my buddy drove me to the hospital. And I remember walking into his room, and, you know, he was still there, and just thinking to myself, man, you are the worst piece of crap there ever was. Like, some of my memories of my father before he died, those 18 months, were being on a drunk, getting in a fist fight with him when he was in the middle of chemotherapy. I became violent, angry, abusive. I was full of so much shame and guilt and self-hatred. I couldn't stand it. I couldn't get to a place of feeling comfortable within my own self. And it just exploded out of me, man. And that's kind of how that went for me. And I wanted so bad for him to be okay before, you know, he died, and he couldn't. And I walked in there thinking, man, why can't he be the one that lived and I die? Why do good people die and people like me, these horrible, like, demon people? That's how I thought about myself. Why do we live? And I don't know. We ended up, like, the week up to his funeral, I convinced my doctor to give me a prescription for Valium. Because you never want to let a good crisis go to waste, right? Like, my dad's dying. I got a lot of anxiety. Give me some Valium. And if you drink Valium and about a liter of vodka every day, that's called a time machine. You will teleport a week at a time, right? And that's what happened for me. And I know that the day of his funeral, I was sitting in the front row, you know, with a pint of vodka in my back pocket, eating Valium, burying him, and then after the funeral, I left, and my mom ended up finding me. And I can't even imagine this, right? The day after she buried her husband, she finds me on the floor of her house, blue, because I had stopped breathing. When you take enough of those downers, those pills and that drink, your body just shuts down. And that's what I was doing, you know? And I didn't do it on purpose. I just wanted my mind and my whole being to shut off. I couldn't stand being awake or conscious. And she found her son blue, you know, and she called the ambulance, and they brought me back to life, and they brought me to the hospital. And then after the hospital for 2 or 3 days, I came home, and all I could think about was how I could get drunk. How can I get this guilt and this awfulness off of me? And I don't know. I'm a guy that wasn't against being violent with anybody to get relief. I was not against that. And for some reason, I just didn't have that fight in me. And I went up and I detoxed myself with the Valium prescription that I had. I had enough experience in detoxes and rehabs to know how to do it, right? So I just detoxed myself. And after 6 days of that, I asked my mother to bring me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And I'll tell you, what I'm about to share with you, I really believe is a gift, because I was a guy that came to AA that could not hear Alcoholics Anonymous. I could not hear what you were saying to me. I couldn't do it. No matter how bad I needed to or wanted to, I couldn't hear you. My ego was like, I had a force field that would just bounce the truth right off of it and just judge the hell out of you and tell me why you're wrong, I'm right, you're stupid, I'm smart. And I didn't even know that I was being punked by myself that way for years. And so here's what happened. I came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the difference was, is I could hear you. That's the only thing that was different. I could hear you. And people shared their experience, and I heard it. And I didn't poke holes in it, and I didn't break them down and judge them for whatever. I felt it. And I ended up at this place in Rochester. There's a clubhouse down here in the city that I used to go to a lot and, like, try to, you know, panhandle some money to get a steel reserve or some cigarettes. And I'd go there, and there was a guy there named Roland. And Roland was there. The meetings used to go from 4 p.m. till 1 a.m. every day. And I would go there, and I heard this guy Roland talk. Roland had 13 years sober. Roland was, I didn't know this at the time, but he was actually a homeless guy in Rochester. But he was 13 years sober. And when he talked, it was like everything stopped for me. Everything stopped. The noise stopped. And I could really hear him, you know? And I would stare at him and I would hope that he would be there every night and I'd listen to him talk. And after 3 days of me staring at him, he did something that I believe is the responsibility of members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe it is my responsibility. I believe it is our responsibility because, right, if he would have waited for me to express my willingness and walk across that room and say, Roland, I'm dying, man. Can you please help me? I wanted to make that walk. It's not like I didn't want to make that walk, but I just couldn't make the walk, man. I was so full of self-hatred and fear, and I couldn't look up off the ground, you know, and I wouldn't have made the walk. It might as well have been me walking to Johnson City from Rochester, New York, same distance to walk across the room. But I am so grateful for Roland. Roland was an amazing member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He saw me probably staring at him. And I don't think it was very hard to understand that I was a newcomer. it was probably pretty easy to see that about me. And after one of the midnight meetings, he walked across the room with a big book. He had gotten a big book on his own time. He took it with a highlighter and he underlined and highlighted the important parts from the doctor's opinion through page 63, our third step. And he asked me to come talk to him at the basement of this clubhouse after the meeting. And I'll tell you guys, like, I wasn't an amazing draft pick in AA. I wasn't someone that was like, I want to be his friend. You know what I mean? Like, I was liable to just burst into flames at any moment. I was not, you could tell something was very wrong with me, you know? And he did what Alcoholics Anonymous does, man. He came up to me and he offered me this way of life. And it changed the entire trajectory of me for the last 17 years. It changed everything. You know, I truly believe that there's one thing that I must bring to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I brought a lot of things before I brought this and AA never worked. And I know the people I was around. I was around solid AAs, and I couldn't hear them. And when I finally got to that desperate place inside of me, when I got to that place of just complete collapse, right, I had to bring an open-minded, willing person to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all I have to bring. That's it. And that's what was there. That's what I brought. And that'll, from my experience, is that will last me for a certain period of time. I will be able to stay sober from that for a certain period of time. But unless I have some type of experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that makes it so that my life is okay sober, that I can be happy and sober at the same time, there's no chance I'm going to stay sober. I'll drink again until I die. And there's nothing that I can do about it. And so I've been sober since that time for 17 years. I've done it, and I'm in the game. And I'm convinced if Roland or someone like Roland hadn't walked up to me at that time and done what we do in AA, I wouldn't be here today. I would have drank again. I know it. I know it to be true. I know it to be true. And he brought me into the basement of this club and he talked to me about himself. He never said, Alex, don't you see what happens when you drink? Just stop drinking. If he would have said that, I would have said, okay, thank you. See ya. You know, he never told me how I hurt other people. He just talked about himself and how it was for him and how it was for him to drink, what drinking did for him and what it was like to be sober and the attempts that he made. And I identified with him so much so. I identified with him so much so after I don't know how many hours of conversation that I asked him a question. And the question was, when I go home tonight and I can't sleep and the picture of my father being dead with all that guilt and shame is on my mind, and the woman that I hurt, and I didn't get into her tonight in her story. I don't want to waste time, going to that, because I want to talk about being sober too. But when I think about that, when I think about my mother, when I think about all these things, and it feels like the clock is going backwards and I can't sleep, what do I do? And all I can think about is I know how to make this madness go away for just at least a moment. I'll deal with the consequences tomorrow. I can make it go away for just now. What do I do? And he said something that made no sense to me. He said, have you ever tried prayer? That's what he said to me. You ever tried prayer? And for a guy that's an atheist, huh? Like, how does that? I don't understand. You know, and the illness of alcoholism, I know today, is not one of logic or rationale. It doesn't make sense. It's not based on any of that. It's insanity. We have an insane mind when it comes to our thought process around drink. And the answer isn't rational. The answer isn't logical. The answer is spiritual. And that makes no sense to me when it came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But here's the thing. It doesn't have to make sense for it to work. I don't even have to think it's going to work for it to work. I just got to do it. And the thing that got me in the position to do it was that, one, I knew I was screwed, and I knew that I was screwed. I just knew it. And number two was Roland. I knew Roland was like me. Roland had what I have. He's got what I got. And Roland says, this is what he did. And I said, oh, well, Hail Mary. Hail Mary. I don't got any other answer. And I got on my hands and I got on my knees with him, and I held his hands, and he said a prayer, and I followed him. And I don't remember what I said. No idea. I don't remember what he said. I said, I know the spirit of it was like, I need you, God. I need you. And my heart was just like, what my heart said was, I am screwed, and I'll do anything Roland says I need to do to recover from this thing. Those are the first three steps. Really, that's it. You know, and I'll tell you, I wish that our experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is that you get really broken. You say a prayer at 4 a.m. in a city clubhouse, and you have a spiritual experience, and then you live happily ever after. That's not the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not. I did have a spiritual awakening. I did find this like hope in me. And that's all that I did. I went to a halfway house. I started going to 4 meetings a day. And little by little, I became sicker and sicker, or I ended up getting hospitalized in sobriety twice in the psych ward. I don't have severe mental illness, right? I just was so full of this disease. And finally, my roommate at the halfway house said, maybe you got to find another sponsor, take the rest of the steps. And I said, I think you're right, man. And I went to a meeting, and I asked a guy to sponsor me. And I joined that to be my home group. And I think I had like 3 months sober or something like that at the time. And he ended up meeting with me once a week, and we went through every word, every page of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, not from an academic point of view, not from a, let me quote this crap so I sound good, because that's going to do zero for any of us, right? You'll sound good, but I'm dying. You know what I mean? But more about like, how do I live and implement this program of action into my life? Like, what does this program tell me to do? And I didn't understand it. All I knew is this, like, I look forward to that weekly meeting with Stephen. That was my most, like, I look forward to meeting with the sponsor. Because when he read that book to me, I was all over it. I was all over the damn thing. You know what I mean? And that gave me a lot of hope. Because maybe if I'm one of these people, like people like that recover. And so maybe that can happen for me too, you know? And I went through the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe what happened for me, this is like what I believe is the transformation that has to happen for me and what I've seen for others, you know, is like, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous a taker. All I thought about was me. How I looked to you, what you thought about me, all I thought about was me. And when I finally came to AA, I had to become a receiver. I had to have enough humility to be able to say, I need help. I need your help. I don't know what I'm doing. And I came here and I became a receiver. And you guys served me to the point where I had a spiritual awakening. And that spiritual awakening drove me to become a giver. I have to go from being a taker to a giver. It has to happen or I'll die. And I don't know how to do that. I'm not sure how to make it so it's not all about me. And what's crazy, guys, what's crazy to me, I'll never forget sitting in my sponsor's van after working with him for a few months, and he was reading Working with Others to me out of the big book, which explained how you sponsor people and stuff like, you know, how you sponsor people. And I remember feeling like I would never be a guy that could sponsor. I'm too sick, too much of a loser. I can never be like these men I see in AA that are just like heroes. You know what I mean? I can't do that. And I remember being in his van, and where I live, there's a big saying that says, we call sponsees pigeons. And I think I hear it's a thing back from Dr. Bob's days, whatever. But the moral of it is that we come in here and we're like a pigeon with a broken wing and we can't fly. And the sponsor puts us into the cage and they nurse us back to health. And the most loving, amazing thing a sponsor can say is when the sponsee, the pigeon, is back to full strength, they open up the door and say, go fly, be a carrier pigeon. Go fly and carry this message. And every sponsee would look for that day when their sponsor would say, you can sponsor guys now. Go look for sponsees, right? Go fly, you know? And I remember he told me that. He goes, you're ready, man. You're ready to go sponsor people. And there's obviously a part of me that was like so scared, right? Because I'm going to kill him. And then there was another part of me that couldn't wait to find the newcomer. Couldn't wait. I had been given a gift. You know, I think it took me 4 months to take the steps and have to go through the 12 steps and have a spiritual awakening. And like I came here before that 4 months, I was convinced that dying was the only answer for me. I was hospitalized in the psych ward twice in that time when I was sober before I took the steps. Like I couldn't live successfully without drinking, and I couldn't live successfully while drinking. I was screwed. And I went through this process in Alcoholics Anonymous, and like I was laughing and I felt a little bit lighter, and my family was seeing me a little bit again, you know, and I started to feel like I had a purpose. I show up to my home group and I make coffee and I set up chairs. I started to feel like I belonged on this planet. I felt like I was a part of a community. Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in it just loved me so much. I felt so unlovable. I felt so ugly and disgusting. And they gave me the big love of Alcoholics Anonymous, man. And I don't know. I know there's a lot of people here that can understand what I'm saying. And like, I don't know, when that touched me that way, I couldn't help but have this burning desire in me to give that love to somebody else. I just couldn't, you know, and I'll tell you, it's been 16 and a half, whatever years since then. I've never not had a sponsee, you know, never not had a sponsee, never not had a home group. You know, I'm not going to sit here and talk to you about me being perfect because I wasn't, and I'm not. Like, I'll talk to you a little bit about my spiritual sickness after being sober, but the thing that I've done all along is I have tried and been really intense about trying to carry this message to other people. You know, it's the one thing I tell my wife, if a newcomer calls and they are dying and they need me, I'm going. I'm just going. Because that was given to me. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the love and the kindness of these strangers. I wouldn't. You people saved my life. And I owe it to AA. And I'll tell you what happened for me is that, you know, I got rocketed into a new world. And my life started to progress pretty quickly. You know, I tell you, by about 9 months sober, I remember I called my sponsor one day and I was complaining because, I had no friends, right? And you hear this in AA all the time. I used to hate this. AA is the greatest show on earth. I have real friends today. And I'm like, well, screw you. You know, like I know a lot of people, right? And no one's calling me. Right. No one's like, you know, like they see me in a meeting. Hey, but I'm no friends and I'm pissed about it because you're all some hypocrites, you know. And so I called my sponsor with that and he said something to me. He goes, Alex, how about the hell with you and who your friends are? How about what are you doing? Like all you ever think about is how to make you feel warm and fuzzy. Think about how you can serve others. Go to meetings, see how you can serve others, what you can do to add value to others' lives. And so I didn't like that answer, but I was willing to follow the direction. And I'll tell you, it's amazing that not long after that, a guy gets sober and I start going to meetings with him every day. And I would sit out with him until like 3 a.m. talking AA. And he would thank me so much for what I was doing for him. And I just wanted to thank him because I felt like I was connected to, I was being of purpose. I had a reason to live. Like I was being used. You know, every day I'd call him and I would hope that he'd answer and let me go hang out with him and talk to him about sobriety. And he'd answer, and I go, oh, thank God he answered, you know? And I think he was probably thinking the same thing, like, will he call me, you know? And this beautiful thing happened. He got sober, and then another guy got sober. And next thing you know, we had this a guy in our area that has a long-term sober, did that too. And he's like, you know, let's open up a meeting on Saturday nights because there's a lot of newcomers on Saturday nights, and there's not a lot of big meetings around our area that carry this message around here. So he opened up what's now my home group. It's been 17 years later, you know? And it was like 5 of us. And every day we look at the window as people would pull up into the parking lot. We'd say, someone's here. You know what I mean? Right. And today we have 40 home group members, right? Over 100 people come here. And I got to fight off people to talk to the newcomer. I love that. I think that's great. You know, and, you know, I have more people in my life today than I can ever even dream of, you know? And it's just incredible to me. You know, like, how do you get over that self-hatred? How do you get over that guilt and that shame? You know, sponsor men that come from, like, literally the homeless shelters with no teeth and give them the love of Alcoholics Anonymous, watch them get well, and then be asked to stand at their wedding as their best man and give a talk about who they are. And then when they have their first baby, be the first person in the hospital to hold their new baby. Like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? How does that not heal your soul? You know, I don't know. You know, I've been a guy that I've been lucky. I've been asked to, officiate, that's the word, officiate weddings for like people in AA. I've officiated like 15 weddings for people in AA. And it's one of my favorite things to do. I didn't think, I was really scared. And I ended up, one person asked me, and I stood up there with them, and I literally think I took 2 days off of work and spent like 40 hours writing this. I was so stressed out. I wanted to do a good job. And I sat up there and I just thought, man, how is God using me like this? I got to feel the love of the family and speak to that and witness that. And I just, AA has put me in a position to just really know what it's put me in a position to do is to let all those lies and all that broken crap that I thought about myself die off so that who I really am could come to the surface and just be, you know, like that's been my problem. And a lot of people have this happen to them. I'm not unique in that. At 5 years sober, I went through what people call in AA a second surrender. And I know I'm not unique. I hear they happen again, you know. And you know, I went from being a guy on welfare, going to AA meetings all day, carrying the message, to then trying to get a job and trying to, like, be self-supporting. And that's scary, right? Like, I'm convinced the boss is going to find out who I really am and fire me. I ended up getting a girlfriend. And she had a daughter, and then we ended up moving in together. And I was so scared she was going to find somebody better than me. And I was so scared I was going to make enough money to be able to pay the bills. And what I found is that, like, I can only have enough God in my life as my life requires me to have. And what do I mean by that? I mean, as if I'm living up to this certain point, right? When I have no wife, no daughter, no, I don't need God in those areas of my life, because I don't have those areas. They don't exist. And for me, what I have found, when I go into uncharted territory, my first instinct is often that of agnosticism, or even worse, prejudice. Not even that God doesn't exist, but that God doesn't even care. I believe God will keep me sober for the rest of my life. I believe that. I believe God is very interested in me being sober. I didn't think God gave a crap about whether I could pay my bills or not. I didn't think God gave a crap whether or not I could be a husband or a father. So when God can't do it, guess who has to? Me. I do. And guess what skills and tools I've discovered that I throw and use to try to fight those fights? They're called character defects. That's what they are. That's what I do. My whole life, I've built a whole bunch and accumulated a bunch of character defects that I use when I am very, very scared. And you put me in a position where I don't feel confident or I don't feel like I'm going to be okay. That's where I'm going in the tool bag of self. I'm going back into the defects. And what does that look like? Anger. I started getting rageful again. I started becoming emotionally and verbally abusive to my wife, just like my dad was to my mother. In sobriety. I couldn't sleep at night. I was full of anxiety and depression. I would be unable to get out of bed for weekdays at a time. But here's the big kicker, is I had built an image and an ego in Alcoholics Anonymous where I wouldn't want you to see the truth about me. And so when you saw me at meetings, none of that was happening. None of that was happening. I was the poster child for Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah? And in my home, I was a terrorist. And I couldn't get out of bed. And I felt lonelier and lonelier and more isolated and more isolated. And I'll tell you, like, I thought the only answer for my life at that time was to do more Alcoholics Anonymous. Nothing else I'd ever known worked. When things are bad, just do more AA, you know? And so I did more AA, and it got worse. It got worse. And I really didn't know what was going on. I was really scared because I don't know what to do. And you know what? I ended up going through the steps with another sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we went through them at a level of depth that I didn't have in the beginning. And we really looked at the principles of the steps in every area of my life. He asked me the question, why are you playing God? If you looked at my life, every area I was managing was so unmanageable, so unmanageable. But yet I was forced to say I could manage those areas. And he said, why? You talk about God. Why don't you let God do it? And when I was honest with him, I said, because if I do, then I'll fail. That's what I thought about God. That's not going to work. I got to work. And so I had to take it. To me, that's a new look at the second step of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came in here, it was like, can God relieve me of the insanity around the first drink? And then now it's like, can God relieve me of the insanity that I can manage my life well by myself, or that God's not good? Like, that's the insanity. And I started to pursue a relationship with God, with that kind of God, in all those areas of my life. I got an opportunity to talk on a panel about how do you grow spiritually? That's a really cool question. I really like that question. I don't know if this is anybody else's answer. My answer to that is get off the bench, get in the game, and do the stuff that scares you to death. It will force you to grow. Right? I could still be living on welfare in an apartment. And this is my life. I had an apartment with a 13-inch TV hole with burn holes on it for my cigarettes, 3 pairs of clothes that didn't match, a lazy boy with one armchair missing, right? But I sponsored a couple of guys, and I was the treatment rep for my home group, and I was on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you would have asked me at that time, I would have said, let me live like this to the day I die. I'm good. You know? But I never would have had this growth. I had to take leaps of faith and get off of welfare and get a job. That was really scary to me. Like, really scary. You know? I got a job cleaning a parking lot of a grocery store. You know? And then I got a job at the corporate world. And I was so scared because I don't have a college degree. What are they going to think? And they're going to find out I'm a fraud, right? You know? And little by little, I just kept getting and moving into uncharted territory that scared the crap out of me. And I struggle. I think struggling and making mistakes is good. I think it's good. That means I'm growing. And I have a choice. Either, and it's what the 12 and 12 talks about, either I act like a boy and I just go back to my defects of character or hurt people when I struggle, or I go to God. And I take a look at myself and say, what's not working? Why isn't it working? Why am I so scared? What's my broken idea? Why am I fighting God? Why am I fighting reality? And I surrender. And that's how I keep growing. You know, it's amazing. I'll tell you, like, you get some time in AA and like, if for me anyway, it feels like my growth is like in millimeter by millimeter, day by day, as compared to it was when I was new, you know? But I look a year ago from where I was, I look a year back from where I am today. Like, who is that guy? I wouldn't agree with some of the things that I said. You know, like, I've changed. And that's good. It's really good. You know? You know, I had to do a lot of therapy. Just 2 months ago, guys, I came out and told my wife, I didn't tell anyone this for decades, that I had been sexually abused as a child by a male for like 8 years. No, it's not. I lied to you. For five years. You know? I was holding that secret. I told my first sponsor, and that's it. And I was holding that lie, and I had so much shame and guilt, and I'd have fits of rage and anger come out of me sometimes, and I knew I got to talk about that thing. And I said, shut up. No, you don't. You know, just ignore that away, right? And I finally, just 2 months ago, I went to my wife and I told her what had happened to me. And I was so scared she was going to see me as a different, like, she's not, you know, he's not mad enough to be my husband, or all these lies that, you know, and it's been one of the most freeing experiences of my life. I'm in the middle of the therapy on it right now. And sometimes it's really hard, and sometimes it's not, and sometimes it's great. But I know I'm on the right track, and I'm doing the right stuff, and God's got me, you know? And that's just been the kind of the story of my alcohol of my life, you know? And you know, my daughter's about to turn 18. She's graduating from, high school. You know, I love kids. I love kids. I like kids more than I like adults. I think they're just like bundles of God. You know what I mean? I just think there's no, like, the ego isn't just amazing. And, you know, I can't have kids. My wife and I tried to have kids, and we can't have kids. And she said that it was too much for her to do all the shots and, you know, all the things that have to happen to try to help with that. And so, and she was making, it was crushing her, but she was scared it would make me sad if I couldn't have my own biological kid. And I don't want my wife to go through that kind of pain and torment and torture. So I said, it's okay. But you know what? I got to have a stepdaughter who's truly my daughter. I raised her since she was 3 years old. I just drove home with her the other day, a couple months ago. I brought her to Philadelphia to go see a 76ers game. And she loves basketball. And we were driving home talking, and I got to talk to her about what had happened to me as a kid from a very high level. And it made sense. The context made sense. And I got to share that with her. And then she shared some stuff with me. And I got to go with her to her therapist and talk. Like, I get to be this thing for my daughter. She is, like, I don't even know how to put words on it. I just love her so much, and I have this gift of her, you know? And I want to tell you real quick about an amends, because I know I got about 4 minutes, and I'll be done. And I want to tell you the amends with my dad, so I think it's important. So I did make an amends to my father. How do you make that right? I couldn't sleep at night for years because of that guilt and shame. And I did what the big book said. I wrote a letter, and I went to this grave site, and I made it, you know, I read the letter, and I cried, and all, you know, it was good. It was good. And then 3 years later, I was doing an inventory with my sponsor, and I was talking about a resentment towards a woman at my home group. And he goes, that inventory is a bunch of smokescreen crap. He goes, you still haven't forgiven yourself for what you did to your dad. I don't know how sponsors see those things, but they do. And he said, I want you to go home and get quiet and see what else you can do to make it right. And I did. And I got an inspiration to ask my mom to go to the grave site with me and make amends to both of them to what I did for their marriage, to their marriage. And I was so scared. And I went there and I made that amends to my mom and my dad together as a couple to what I did for the marriage. And then I was at my home group not long after that. And there's one of these like tear off signs, like a sheet of the tear off sign that said, drive people to that have cancer to chemo kind of thing. And I'll tell you, there's times that I didn't bring my dad to chemo because I got too drunk and I was supposed to. Like, you know, and God smacked me across the face. Might as well have been, and said, that is what you got to do. And I said, but I am too scared of God. I don't like that answer. And I didn't. I was about 3 years sober. At 8 years sober, I was balking on that amends. And I started to sponsor a guy that was new to me. Been in sobriety, but new to me. And I started talking to him about how I was balking at those amends. And I love that my sponsees, I don't look at it like a hierarchical thing. I think that's just not for me. I'm a drunk like they're, we need each other. I need to share my warts and my brokenness with my sponsees just as much as they need to share it with me. And so I do that. And I told him about how I'm balking. And he said, I know people in the hospice community. I can get you hooked up. And I'm just ready. And I ended up getting hooked up, and I made a year commitment to volunteer people that were dying of dementia to be a friend. I was going to be a friend to them. And I remember my first appointment, I was going to go see the first woman that they were stay assigned to me. And I thought that I would go into this like nursing home thing and that God would pretty much just carry me out floating after because of what a great guy I was, you know. And I went into there, and she was not far away from dying. She was in a coma already. And I sat there for an hour and I prayed. I talked to my dad, whatever. And I left and it felt like my skin was going to fall off my body. I was having pretty much a panic attack. And I called my sponsor and I said, I don't want to do this anymore, man. And he said, when did you ever think that things that are good feel good, that things that are bad feel bad? My whole life, I've lived a lie that says if it feels good, it's good. If it feels bad, it's bad. And if you're going to grow spiritually, if you're going to really grow through some hard stuff, you can't go around the fire. You gotta go through it. There's just no choice. And I did. I made a year commitment to do that. I'll never forget. Like a year later, I went to see my last, friend. I call her friend, and she was an Irish woman with an Irish accent. And I walked into her room, and she said she thought that I was her long lost brother from Ireland. And I had a decision. Like, I'm a good liar, you know. So I pretended to be her long lost brother from Ireland. I'm not gonna tell her. No, I'm not. You know. I felt like that was the nice thing, the kind thing to do. And so I sat there with her for a couple hours and I pretended as though I was her brother from Ireland and we talked. And at the end of that, she said, I'm so scared to die. And I don't know how to die gracefully because I've never done that before, but I do know how to be scared. And I said, will you pray with me? And I held her hands and we said a prayer together. You know, and I walked out feeling free. And let me tell you this, how big God is. Not long after that, my wife's brother, who had a serious mental illness, alcoholism, drug addiction, got beat up so bad that he was in a coma for a week at the hospital. And me and her used to drive an hour and a half every day to go see him. After 5 days, he was still in the ICU. I put my arm around, I said to her, my wife, I said, we got to pray over him. I put my arm around her. As soon as she was going to speak, his eyes opened up. I'm not lying to you. These are things that I would say, yeah, right. Not lying to you. We invited him to come live with us. And he's a sicko just like me. And I love him. I love him when he's broken. And he got to go sit with me and my sponsees in my man cave and smoke cigars and talk crap and talk AA. And after a little while, after 6 months, we had to ask him to leave because he wasn't getting well. Long story short, guys, he ended up dying of a fentanyl overdose. And my wife came home after she found out, and she was sobbing. And I said, we've done everything we could. We did everything we could. And she goes, Alex, that's not why I'm crying. She goes, I'm crying because, you know, see, I'm an extrovert. When I was able to do Alcoholics Anonymous and get the poison out of me, who I am is like a teddy bear. I love people. I love to spread joy. I love making people feel good. And not many people did that for him in his life. My wife couldn't even do that for him, but I could. And she said, Alex, because of the way you invited him and treated him in our home, I'm square with my brother before he died. And to what I did to my old man, to what I was able to do for my wife, are you kidding me? They asked me to do the eulogy at his funeral. And it just so happened that that weekend, my sponsor and I put on a men's retreat in Rochester where 50 men from across the country and some from Canada all left the retreat to go to that funeral and bear witness and be there for us. You can't make it up, you know? And I don't know. All I know is that that's the God that we get to serve. That's the God that's loving me in my life. And my hope is this. This is really, truly my hope. I know I'll have other dark days. I'll have other difficulties. I know that I'll hurt other people and make more amends. My hope, though, is that no matter what, I stay small enough to make God and keep God God and me me and continue to get up and walk on this path to become a better and just a servant to God and to you. You know, that's what I want more than anything. And I hope I could do that with everything that I have. So thank you for letting me be with you and share with you all. I hope you all have a good night.